Welcome back to Hal's second in a series of four, which there'll be two more tomorrow, one at 11 and 2:30. And today's topic is extremely intriguing to me. Wild and humor-filled early Christ supper cooks. Who knew, right? So we're anxious to hear. Thank you, Hal.
Is it potluck, sir?
I don't know.
I'm sure.
Well, I think that our conversation yesterday went so fast that I want to start at the beginning with just any chance for anything you would like to bring up from yesterday. I've had probably 9 or 10 conversations with you since then, and been learning a lot myself and noticing some things that I probably didn't say very clearly. So take a moment to think if there's something you'd like to catch up on that you didn't get to talk with me about, or that prompted even more conversation. Let me just remind you of, two projects for this time up here in Holden. One was helping people who wanted to think about Lent and their Lent spiritual practice. We've done that twice, and so much for that. Now we have four sessions. We're in our second that's based on a larger project that I've been working on for a good 5 years with a fairly large seminar called the West Star Christianity Seminar. And this is a project that in which we are trying to rethink how to do a history of the first 2 to 4 centuries. We're aiming for the first of what became Christianity. And I said yesterday that, so we have 25 or 30 scholars from around the country that meet for a little over a week to work on this material, and we're writing lots of papers and things like that. But what we're noticing is that it's really hard to figure out how to describe historically the first 2 centuries of what became Christianity. The first problem was that as we noted yesterday, the word Christian is hardly used. So how can we do that? But just to say that I've found all of this work very exciting, but so far that you will see major holes in arguments and major holes in rethinking it. So please help us see the holes, help us see the places where your understanding is breaking through into another kind of picture of early Christianity. One thing I would say, just apropos of yesterday, we talked just a little bit about the figure of Thecla, this teenage woman who ran away from home, refused marriage, and became a major teacher and healer in the second century. I realize that I didn't mention something that I'm very excited about relative to Holden and Thecla. And that is, so I and a colleague of mine who is a nationally known musical theater person, we're going to be here for 2 weeks at the end of June, and we're going to produce a musical on the life of Thecla. We're going to write it and produce it. She's a major composer, and we're going to invite people in the class to be a part of it where they want to be. So end of June, if you don't have anything else to do, and you send us people who can sing, Natalie Perkins, who's going to be in charge of that section, since I can't sing, will be composing things. We'll be thinking through the story of Thecla in contemporary terms, and so that's going to be fun. Just to let you know that. Any thoughts about yesterday? In terms of conversation, I would call your attention to the fact that basically the two, what I would call shifts in the way to think about the early Christ groups was around the intense violence of everyday experience during that time. And secondly, which we gave less time to, was the possibility of what I would call a gender-bended Christ, a set of Christ movements in which gender itself was very flexible and reproducing itself in new ways that attracted people to the movement. So those were the two things we tried to talk about yesterday. Or something else. Let's just take a moment or two to see if you have some thoughts, protests, or questions that have been working in you between then and now. Yes?
I just have a quick question because of some of the prior conversations we've had with you when you talked about the research that you found, some of these other documents that mm-hmm. had been found and discovered that yeah. you've used in this research.
Right.
It might be nice to hear just a 2-minute
sure. yeah.
summary
well,
of some of them.
First of all, that's the second talk tomorrow.
Oh, okay, sorry.
in other words, one of the things that makes us rethink all of how we've thought about early Christianity is the fact that in the last 100 years, we've discovered more new documents from that period than we had for the previous 1500. So yes, it's a big deal. I'll save much,
okay,
much
gotcha.
Of that. But I would say one other thing important, that these two things that we focused on yesterday, violence and gender bending, are in both the New Testament, the traditional New Testament, and all of these other new texts that have been discovered. So, in other words, when we try to think now about what were the early Christ movements of the first two centuries like, we've decided we can't just use the privileged documents from Christian tradition. We have to use all of the documents that we now have discovered. So I'm giving a little bit of a tip of my hat to that because it's really important in what we said yesterday, but we'll have a lot more to say tomorrow. Thanks. Yes?
This is void, and you're talking about the void today, but the void also includes nothing was written down during this 200 years. So why is that? And was it all just oral tradition?
Oh, actually, no, there were a lot of things written down. What I saw, for instance, what I used yesterday when I was talking about Roman military power and Roman religion and things like that, that all comes from real documents written by the Romans, as well as, I would say, most of the... We have now probably almost 200 writings from the early Christ movements in the first two centuries that we think were written originally sometime in those 200 years. So I must have misspoken to give the impression that...
Is it in the Bible?
Yes. I mean, the problem is that the Bible also didn't exist then. And no one was saying, let me write a book for the Bible. But the movements that were in one way or another related to Christ, they were cooking with writings. It is true that 95% of them could neither read nor write. So the people that wrote were few and far between. So we'll be talking today, for instance, when you talk about how these, all of these different movements got together, meaning how they joined, how they had a meeting or worship, we'll notice that in many of those cases, the people that gathered, probably none of them could read. So it could be that there was a letter either to them, or somebody got a hold of a letter from Paul to someone else that they now had, and it'd be nice to read it, but no one could read. So you were kind of lucky if you had someone in your gathering that could read. So that wasn't what you asked, but...
It just seems like the Holy Spirit had to be like just juicing it up when 95% of people couldn't read and it was all just word of mouth.
Yeah. Yeah. I think so. No, I think that's right. In other words, this is, in the best way, this is an inspired time for what people were thinking. People, I mean, when you just hear of the atrocities and the changes going on in the Mediterranean world, there are a lot of people thinking overtime. And for instance, a lot of the things that were eventually written down were probably composed orally and then written down later and changed in the process. So yeah, lots of things cooking and lots of good thinking, but I would want to then bring that one example at the beginning of last time also into effect. So we had four documents about gender in the beginning of the second century, which sounded like they were arguing rather than sort of all raising the same flag. So it's not that it was coherent, but it was inspired. And people were thinking over time. Yes?
Is it true that with that much time involved, thousands of years really, that you were talking about copies of documents, copies of documents, and copies of documents? As opposed to they wrote the documents and we now have them, that's too far back for those documents to have survived.
Yeah, yeah, that a wonderful way to show that, you know, about some holes in my presentation. So, for instance, most of the even in the regular New Testament, we don't have any document, any manuscript that's complete in the first 200 years. We're almost sure that they were written, but we only have copies of copies of copies. So, in other words, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, we have no complete copy, no complete manuscript that in the first 200 years. And then I love occasionally, and it's in the New Testament, you can see there's a picture of the first piece of any document that we have, and that's from the first part of the second century. And it's that big, one little piece of the Gospel of John. And that's after 100 years. So in other words, we know that there were multiple copies of that. We just don't have them anymore. All right, well, so let's, nobody's been injured in my laying out all of that violence from yesterday, I guess, so we can go on. We'll return to it a little bit today. But what I want to talk about today is, and again, Sharon's right, this is like one of the biggest kept secrets you can imagine. And that's, how did the early Christ people have a meeting or have worship? How did they get together? And so, you know, if you're me, I went through my first 20 years of life assuming that they had church just like we did. Because that was the way our church sounded, is that they were just had taken this. And it's pretty far from that. So the first thing I need to tell you about is something that's not in the early Christ movements, but the early Christ movements took over. And that's, in common parlance, is what we call the supper clubs of the Greco-Roman era, the supper clubs. And I'm going to describe that a little bit and then fit that in with the early Christ movements. So these supper clubs were just what that says. They were groups that had supper together regularly. They were unions, like you, and we have, we have a whole bunch of documents to and a whole bunch of archaeology that show all of this. But so, for instance, the bricklayers would have a supper club. They'd get together once or twice a month, and I'm going to tell you about what they did. Family groups would have a supper club. I mean, extended family groups. Philosophers would have supper clubs. Religious folks would have supper clubs. So, for instance, the Isis movement, the new movement in the first and second century, gathered around the goddess Isis in Egypt. Now, it turns out that the supper clubs, that Isis supper clubs, weren't much in Egypt, but mostly in Asia Minor and Greece. And that's another story. But you have all kinds of supper clubs, and so the first thing to say is that these supper clubs reclined. So here's the picture, right? So this is a person with whom I wrote a couple of books on this phenomenon, got all of these little pictures of people reclining in a meal. Each one of them is from a vase from the first or second century with that picture on it. And so he just pasted them all together. And he and I and many people have discovered many of the dining rooms that the supper clubs were in, and they looked like this. This is more like in the western part of the Mediterranean, and this is in the eastern part of the Mediterranean. And there's some differences for us to notice in this. But so, and this is getting ahead of myself a little bit in terms of Christ people, but you know, in church when they read and when they were at table, so that's just unbelievably bad Greek translation. Because the word that is translated in our Bibles, and when they were at table, and that's all over the Gospels, is, and when they were lying down. And of course, it doesn't mean when they were going to sleep. It was when they were eating. And this is what it looked like. The rooms are about this size, meaning about that size. This room, for instance, would be a really big space. It's usually about a third to a quarter of this room. And so let's say these are the shipbuilders, or the masons, or the neighborhood society getting together more or less once a week, you're all members, but you can invite your guests. So it's not like it's private society completely. And I'm just talking about the non-Christ people first, who gave the Christ people this idea of how to get together. And here you would eat for about an hour together. You would eat with your hands. It would be fairly simple food, but the fact that you were lying down was the key meaning for them. That is, they wanted to show that they were at ease, that they were relaxing. And in fact, this meal lasted for a good 3 hours every time you got together. This was neither McDonald's nor even church in its length. This was really long. After the first hour of getting a lot of food in you, you have basically a toast for the evening, in which you go into the middle, someone goes up into the middle, or several people, and you raise a, it's not really a cup, it's usually almost always a bowl of wine, or several of them, to the spirit of the evening. So for instance, sometimes a shipbuilder's supper club would raise the bowl to one god, and the next time they'd raise the bowl to another god. The next time they got together. Probably sometimes the shipbuilders would raise a bowl to Christ or to Isis, and they weren't the Isis or the Christ Supper Club. But in other words, the next thing you did after eating, oh, I forgot this. Before you did this raising of the bowl, you invited the dogs in. Because they cleaned up the floor. Because you had, in other words, for instance, since you, when you're eating, you got your hands all dirty. So your napkin was bread. And you try it if you would. If when your hand is dirty, just rub a bunch of bread on it. And it picks up the grease and everything and more or less cleans it. So all of that stuff is on the floor. The dogs come in, pick it up. Probably a few dogs stay, and then that's that. Then the raising of the bowl. And then for the rest of the evening, almost a good hour and a half. Oh, by the way, when you're raising the bowl, you're singing. You're singing songs. And probably for the rest of the evening, you're going to be singing songs now and then. You play games, you have conversation, occasionally you have somebody who gives a little speech. It's mostly known for its relaxedness and its festiveness. The festiveness and the relaxedness does not always mean that you don't have a fight. So the supper clubs were known for fighting. We have that in 1 Corinthians, for instance. Paul said, could you please stop that? Don't be so wild and crazy. So that's the spirit of this. You need to know that in the first and second century, the spread of supper clubs was everywhere. There used to be some supper clubs, but in this time, there were thousands and thousands of them. Rome started worrying about supper clubs. Five different emperors forbid supper clubs to happen. And you know what the supper clubs did? They laughed. Because they knew that the emperor could never shut down all the supper clubs. Governors tried to, in their area, tried to shut down the supper clubs, mainly because the Romans were kind of paranoid about somebody wanting to lead a revolution against them. Maybe they were, maybe they weren't, probably mostly not. They were mostly enjoying one another, talking about life, talking about what happened. So, for instance, I'm sure, relative to what we were talking about yesterday in Roman violence, they'd be talking about who got killed or who got hurt in the last week, as well as singing songs of sadness and joy. So this is the institution already cooking as the Christ movement started happening, and they did like everybody else did. There was basically no other way that Christ people or Israel people gathered together except this. This was, you could call it their worship, or at least was the closest thing to worship they had. They almost certainly, many of their songs were prayers. And almost certainly, many of them were jokes and fun. They played. For instance, have you ever noticed when at the bottom of your wine cup, you can't quite get that last bit of wine out very easily? So there was katobos, was the game you played with the last parts of your wine. So let's say I'm reclining here. Though I would be reclining here because I shouldn't use my left hand in the ancient world. That was for something else, right? So let's say the room is about half the size. So I got my almost empty bowl, and there's a right over there, there's another bigger bowl. And the question is, for both Conrad and me, as we're lying down, if we could flip that last bit of wine into that big bowl. Yeah, see, because it occurs to you immediately that it could be that if I'm aiming for the bowl while I'm lying down, I might hit Conrad in the head. And it could be that, in fact, I try to hit Conrad in the face. So, in other words, that's worship.
Just for the playing.
Beautiful singing, singing to God, singing to Christ, playing games, lying down together. Yes.
Those are women and men, yes?
Yes, yeah, okay, yeah. And this, what I'm going to say next is about both all the other supper clubs and the Christ movements. In this time, the rights of women are expanding. Even though patriarchy is really strong, women in these two centuries gain the right to divorce legally and gain the right to property.
To what?
Property. And that means, because of both of those things and other things happening, it means that women start being in semi-public where they weren't allowed to before. So for instance, here, the women are reclining on one side. That's because in the shipbuilders group, it's even rowdier than the Christ group, and it sometimes looks like this. So you notice who's over here. Here, you have a woman also kind of reclining, but she's topless, and she's a prostitute. So the shipbuilders, they can invite the prostitutes to their supper club. Probably not the Christ people. I don't really know all that much about that. So yes, women were there as full recliners. Oh, no, I'm wrong. So for instance, in the text, and you will notice that you know this, but you don't know that you know this. There are places where, for instance, Paul says about the gathering, he says, we're neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, man nor woman, all are one in Christ. That's what he says about this process. And that means that for certain that the people that Paul is writing have reclining women as full members of relaxed, excited, and joyful people. But we have, for instance, in Luke, Luke has this passage, this makes it complicated what we were saying yesterday, but it is. So you may remember Mary and Martha on the story there. That's also a supper event. And Martha is, of course, fixing the supper and being grouchy about it. Remember that. What's Mary doing? She's not laying around. The text actually says something else. She was sitting at his feet. So, one of the things that we know happens is some Christ groups or other kinds of groups, they say, yes, of course, all are one in Christ. And some say that you know what? Women shouldn't be as relaxed as men. So Mary has to take the posture that is not full relaxedness. She has to sit. So you have on all of the vases and everything in the picture, you will occasionally see a woman sitting at someone's feet. That means she can participate, she can sing, but she always has to demonstrate that she's not fully a man. Right? So this is a time of lots of mutuality in men and women in the Christ movements, but like the rest of society, they are, if that's uneven. So, and then of course, Paul himself talks to the Corinthians and says, if this woman decides she wants to make a speech, she has to have something on her head. I can't tell whether they have something on their head. And then, in another place in the same book, of course, Paul says, that reclining woman isn't allowed to speak. So Paul contradicts Paul's self in Corinthians by saying one time, you have to wear something on your head if you're a woman and want to speak in this position, in this situation. Or three chapters later, he says, no, they're not speaking at all. That really does not show the bottom line, of course, on anything. It just shows that this kind of new situation in that time of really reclining together is kind of new, and some people don't like it. Thanks very much. I probably would have forgotten to talk about that. Okay. All right, so this is what I want to suggest to you, is this is the only way the Christ people worship. We have no other indication of anything. And as I said, even in our Bible book, which we read every Sunday, and we think it says at table, it says, and when they were reclining. So it's not, it's actually hardly any way to argue out of that. Probably we could find some way. All right. Questions, thoughts?
Yeah. One question, one observation. Would this be daily? I mean, the way of eating daily, or would this be once a week?
Oh, thank you. Yeah, that's very it
seems
confusing.
Like a lot of eating for every day.
Yeah. So, the average size of someone's house in that day that's not rich is about this structure. You don't have meals together every day unless you're standing around, and even then it's not anything like what we think. So in other words, the ordinary 95% of people who don't have a villa, this is their house with all their family.
Yep. Could you say that size for the
tape, please? That is like this, that is higher. What? 9 feet by 9 feet?
Okay.
or something. 12 feet by 12 feet, something like that. Yeah, thanks, Carol. Could you please protest and say this can't be, or something like that, or how much you would like to have it this way now? And my proposal, by the way, is not to say just because Jesus did it that we have to do it. I mean, cultures produce what they produce.
Is this mostly non-Jew? You're talking about this at this point?
Oh, see, again, a question way above my pay grade. Here's the nearest to coherent question, is two parts. One, no, we know that synagogues were like this in that time. So for instance, the first time we have a writing about the Passover is in the first century. And do you remember, I mean, the times you've been with your Jewish friends and doing Passover, do you remember what the question is? And why do we recline together? One of the four questions is, why do we recline together? But the second thing is, of course, we learned yesterday that there's no Christians, right? And the Christ people know that they're followers of who?
Moses.
Well, Jesus. Or Moses. Yeah, Moses and Jesus is a good thing. But in other words, they know that their big guy is of spiritual Israel. So it's pretty clear that if you look at all the, you know, if you don't forget that there are hardly any Christians saying Christian at all in the first two centuries, if you sort of say, well, so what were they? Even though most of them are Gentile by the middle of the second century, they think they belong to Israel. So let me just say this a little bit more. So for instance, you know, many of you know that Paul is of Israel, although he lives in current day Turkey for much of his life. And he proposes, Paul never stopped thinking he belonged to Israel. He never said he was a Christian. But he was wanting to make Israel open to everybody. And so he said, you know, we are so far away from the temple when we live in the Asia Minor. So we've already decided 100 or so years ago, as people of Israel who live in Asia Minor, we're going to skip that rule of going to the temple every week. And we're just going to get together and pretend we're in the temple. So Paul then makes another more interesting proposal for those Gentiles who want to be a part of Israel in Jesus. And that is, why don't we skip the circumcision thing? We skip the temple thing. You can't be much bigger than skipping temple, right? So let's just skip circumcision too. So in other words, what I want to say is they think they're Jews. They think they're kind of magical Jews because they know their mother and father are. And some people are saying, yeah, that's right. We all belong to Big Israel. By the way, tomorrow morning we're going to look at the main criteria that has been for what makes a real Christian in the early days, and that's what they believe. So you notice that yesterday I worked on the big cultural context and political context. Today I'm working on the how did they get together context. Tomorrow we'll be thinking about, so how important was believing, and what were they believing, how much did they agree, and the like. Okay, so let's keep open that you have some questions, thoughts, or protests right now about this proposal.
Where does all the food come from?
Right. So the first answer is I don't know. I've been to the Mediterranean and seen a whole bunch of this archaeology. But anyway, here's our best guess. Two ways. But because most of these supper clubs for the Christ people didn't have villas, they didn't have rich people. There are some we know that where the rich person in town said, "Hey, Christ people, come to my dining room." But by and large, you had to do what Jesus did in the story about the Last Supper. Rent a place, right? Rent a room that isn't even a dining room. Bring along some straw and hay, and those are your couches. I'm getting the food. And in those situations, you don't have a kitchen. So you bring your food. And there are all kinds of controversies about what you can bring and what you can't. So for instance, Paul, when he's writing to the Romans, he's writing in the middle of them having a food fight. And their food fight is, some of them think that they should be able to eat meat, and some of them think they should only eat vegetables. Now, this is not a vegetarian movement. But what it is that group is a group in Rome, clearly, of people who belong to Israel and have never had non-kosher meat in their life. And they know that in their neighborhood, their butchers give you, first of all, non-kosher, but secondly, half of it's probably been sacrificed to some other god. So some people are saying, I'm not eating that meat. In the people that Paul is writing to. And the other people said, listen, aren't we free in Christ? And has anybody read chapter 14 of Romans? What does Paul say? Who does he decide on whose side? The vegetarians! He says, you all got to eat vegetables. Because that will offend the least people. So, basically the answer is, if you have a rich person who invites you to a Christ Supper Club, you probably have a kitchen to help you. Otherwise, you bring your own stuff. Now, I want to say one other thing that really confused me. This last August, I was on a dissertation supervision of a new scholar at the University of Toronto, and he had written his PhD dissertation on part of these topics, and he had come up with the idea that basically those of us who've written books on this are probably wrong, and I think he may be right. I don't know. What he said was, So many of these people were poor that they probably didn't have anything but bread and wine. Now, I've seen enough of these pictures to know that they have all kinds of food. I've seen enough lists. But I'm now wanting to rethink. It could be that they pretended this was a lush meal, and they sang and they played jokes and they loved each other and prayed for each other, but they only had bread. they just pretended like it was more than bread. So I'm confused about this. I think it was a great dissertation. And in other words, I've been telling people for the last 20 years that this is that it's hardly any meat, because that's too expensive, but a bunch of vegetables and fruits and bread. And it could be that there are more of those groups that didn't even have the vegetables and fruits. And it wasn't like you get a little cube, right? It was just a lot of bread, because it was cheap. How am I doing?
Well, was there any serving?
Was there any serving? Oh, yes, that's a great question. So yes and no. And actually, there are three options that are pretty clear. So we have to talk slavery, because slavery is everywhere in that. And that's why, for instance, Paul says, you know what? In our meeting, the slaves get to lie down. neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free. That meant that the slaves came in and reclined together. But at the same time, we're pretty sure that if you went to the rich woman who invited you to have your supper club in her dining room, she probably had slaves, and they probably served you. Or they're servants. So servants and slaves are not quite the same thing. In that era, so there, it could be servants. And we do have texts which say, no, we're serving each other. So there are texts that explicitly say, we're not going to have slaves and servants. We're going to provide each other, and we're going to literally serve each other. So for instance, here, this person is a servant. This is a musician. And then I think there's another. So here's the flute girl, and here's a servant. No, this is probably a slave because he's not well dressed. Other thoughts about this? Yes.
When these people were not gathering socially to do this, how did they eat? What was the form of their normal meals?
I may be misunderstanding, but let me say this. So the first hour was food. The next 2 hours was drink.
I mean, if they weren't gathering to eat.
No.
Oh, I see. When they weren't doing that. Standing up in their big house.
Just grab a bite.
Yeah. And part of this was actually, something probably cooking. There's just no place to eat. We're now pretty sure that some groups met in their very poor homes. And a couple of us are trying to get our heads around how would you get a group of 10 or so in your only space. But I think that probably happened too. But not regularly. The people of the Mediterranean don't sit down or lie down to eat two or three times a day. They eat kind of on the run and kind of standing. So that's why these things. So, for instance, if I had your birthday, you would have this kind of thing. You'd go rent a space, and you'd have this whole deal to celebrate your birthday. We have literally birthday invitations that we know.
A side question, you will distinguish the two pictures, one in the east part of the Roman Empire. Can you say what the difference is?
Well, I think the main difference that my colleague who did this was trying to, was the shape of the room. Uh-huh. So for instance, I think the people, you could exchange the people, but you notice this is basically a four-sided room.
The other
is a three-sided room. Yeah, that's the main difference between the triclinium. This is the triclinium in the West.
Yeah, right.
So I want to push the envelope a little bit for you. So what would you feel like if this thing you now know about the early Christ movements and how they worshipped, if that counted for anything? I mean, what do you think of this kind of worship? And what I'm wanting to say is, I don't want to, there's no way we could force people to do this now. But it is a different spirit, isn't it? I mean, this is really, just as an emotional and a human event, This is really different. I'll get to you in just a minute. So for instance, a lot, as you notice, a lot of these couches are 2 and 3 person couches. So regular, I mean, I've seen a bunch of these, the furniture in which, sorry, Elaine. So the 2 person couches, we actually, again, it's amazing that we don't notice this in our Bible reading, but the Gospel of John tells us about 2 person couches and how they do that. When the beloved disciple at the Last Supper was, what was he doing? He was on a 2-person couch with Jesus, and he was laying in Jesus' bosom. So you look, and you, there are plenty of ancient pictures about, so you, if it's a 2-person couch, I'm here, and this other person is lying on my bosom, on my lap, and his feet are sticking out a little bit more. So I mean, you don't, if you don't want to think about that, you don't have to. But even here, I want to say, no wonder they called it the body of Christ when they ate in some of these places. I don't think they called it the body of Christ every place. I think the Christ groups were all over the place on what they said in their prayers and songs. But in some cases, this is so embodied. Oh, no,
I was just going to say that it seems like it would build a very strong community to be eating together for 3 hours once a week. Mm-hmm. It's a very different thing than what most of us do in most worship services. Outside of
yeah, really different. And then so where I'm pushing the envelope is, how would you feel about having a more embodied, close relationship with the people you worship with?
I think that these kinds of gatherings happen already in a way, right, as part of church community. But the difference is that those gatherings are sort of, they're not centralized, right? They're the opposite of the proper worship, mm-hmm. right? Not the opposite, but so
yeah,
just like the in terms of the where the center of power is, right? So people do that already. You know, Altar Guild has a brunch, and you know, people have supper groups and potlucks and whatnot. But it's kind of the extra stuff. When the truth is, lots of times that's the most lively, intimate experience. And maybe even a coffee hour starts to get closer to that or whatever.
Yeah.
But it's not, you know, it's been marginalized and it's not considered the proper worship. So we can talk about who has authority and, you know, in terms of the state also.
Yeah. Oh, so very helpful. I occasionally say that 21st century, well, even as of the 17th century, you have dehydrated worship. So it's just a tiny piece of bread, a little bit of thyme, and a tiny bit of drink.
Yeah, I just want to mention what you're saying reinforces to me what I've learned about the Curcio movement, which is started in the Catholic Church and it's now Presbyterian and Lutheran in various forms, but the idea was to get back to how did the followers of Christ live their lives in those first centuries, and how did they gather, and how did they interact with each other, and around the meal, and around the sharing, and the praying for each other, and the extended communion, basically.
I just keep coming up with the general shape of worship that we've had a lot of discussion about in the last 10 years, that the general shape of worship is to gather, to sing hymns, to hear the word, to have the meal, and to be sent. And so this shape is still present here. Mm-hmm. And that shape that we talk about in worship this day, regardless of whether we're sitting in pews, not talking to the person next to us, if we can possibly manage it, or not. If we're, I find that this is a cultural difference, not necessarily a content difference.
And how, if I put the word spiritual in the mix, is it the same or different?
I don't know that. When you gather to worship, of course, it's community-oriented, not self-oriented.
Yeah.
And yet, in our community of worship, we find ourselves not touching people, that really, that we are working to share the peace more effusively, to gather together more effusively. We're working on that sort of concept, and perhaps that's because of some of this discussion. But I think the general shape of the worship is still remains the same, and how our culture reflects that is very different from town to town, to denomination to denomination, and from state to state, from region of our countries to, I think it's just very different culturally from one step to the next.
Thanks, Vicki, for making that point, because of course I was also making the other point, that it really is different. So, so it's good to have those both of those voices.
How did this kind of gathering and worshiping, if that's what they were doing, contrast with, say, Jews who went to temple, or the Romans who, I don't know how they worshiped their gods, but how did this?
Yeah. Well, again, that's where I may be wrong about using the word worship. So, for instance, what happened in Judaism, of course, was that the main place that they worshipped, the temple, in which they had huge dining rooms. So for instance, you know what you did with most of the, the communion worship, the communion offering in the big temple, you know why they called it communion? Is because there were rooms in the temple in which you went and ate it together. So when the Jerusalem temple was destroyed by Rome, there was a huge crisis in, so what do we do now? And there, the Christ people and the Pharisees had already started something else. Both had moved to the home. Both the Pharisees and the Christ people said, you know, the Romans are just collaborating too much with the temple. You know, you had, Rome said you have to pray for the emperor every day in the temple. And that was just a bit too much. So the Pharisees, even before Jesus, they had started saying, listen, could you just bring everything home? Bring the kind of instruments you have and the temple, bring them to your home. Make your home holy. Because we're worried about the temple and it not being really holy. And then, of course, what happened to the Christ people is, so I'm not, Jesus, he was known for as being a glutton and a drunkard. And they don't, that's what the names they called him, right? In the Bible, is because he went to so many of these gatherings. I mean, I don't know about his drinking at all, but I do know that that he was a supper guy. And so here's where I may be wrong in calling what all of this is in the Christ groups worship. What I do know is they sang lusty religious songs. They talked about the body of Christ. They played games. So I don't know whether that qualifies as worship. So it could be that there was no worship for the first 200 years. But it sounds like it was very meaningful, whatever it was. Getting to the other people, how did the the Romans and all the other peoples of the Mediterranean, they also relied on almost exactly the same system as Israel did in terms of temple. All temples in the Mediterranean had a whole bunch of dining rooms attached to them. And you, what we'd do is you would burn the meat and bring it to all of the dining rooms. And there you would have a long meal. And that, I think, you'd have to say is worship because there was sacrifice. But it was beautiful sacrifice. I want to say the pagan, the Gentile, and the Israelite temple system was so beautiful and lush and personal and festive. Time's up. Thank you.
Thank you.